Expressed on the following show may not be those of the guests, hosts, or WSPN. Talk Saratoga is produced by Saratoga Broadcasting Incorporated and may not be reproduced in part or in whole unless written approval is given. Now, the hosts of Talk Saratoga, Rick Thompson and Lynn Goodness.
Good morning and welcome to Talk Saratoga. I'm your host, Rick Thompson. As everyone knows, Lynn isn't with us anymore. And so I'll be doing a new intro. We'll have our Saratoga All-Star rotating co-host on from now on. But I'm here with Sue Beebe, and I like Sue so much, I'm going to do the show by myself. How's that?
Sounds good.
All right. Good morning, Sue. How you doing?
Good morning. I'm doing well.
Okay. We got a new system here.
And I see.
Yeah, and it's a little bit, still a little bit fuzzy with me. So bear with me. The board should be okay. It's how to get into the PSAs and all that stuff. But anyway, we're glad you're here. Why don't we start out, for anybody listening new, who you are and what you do.
Okay. I am Sue Beebe. I'm with Cornell Cooperative Extension of Saratoga County. And I am what they would refer to as an agricultural issue leader. I deal with all the various ag programs in the county, and but my specialty is in the area of horticulture. So I work with all the local nurseries, greenhouses, etc. Also do a lot on turf management, working with school systems and the like. So it's a very extremely varied title as to all the different things that I do through Cooperative Extension. And I also am the assistant director there, so I wear many, many different hats dealing with all kinds of items that you would have coming into play. And also working with the 4-H Youth Program as well. And, we have an upcoming, actually, session on Monday night with them, to start out the new 4-H year. So I've got some youth there that are anywhere between 8 and 18 that we work with on, teaching horticulture and the identifying plants. And that's kind of the big topic that we really concentrate ourselves on, is plant identification. And you don't think of that as the common things that we might think of when we think plant identification, taking a look at just a leaf. We look at root systems. They may have to ID it from the seed, maybe the flower, maybe just a twig. So over the years, they'll learn to identify 150 different plant specimens by all of those characteristics. So
that's great. So we're training the youth to
We are hoping that they will learn to nurture what nature has out there and
excellent.
Carry it on.
Excellent. Agriculture used to be, or still is, the number one industry in Saratoga County. Is it still, or are condos the biggest industry in Saratoga County?
Well, we're still growing in that area as well, but agriculture is definitely right up there, at the top. And the Economic Council just last week had a nice big meeting over at Chip Elms's farm in Charlton, and discussing how much agriculture really means to Saratoga County. And when you throw everything in as part of ag, including the track, that number becomes very, very large.
Yeah, I know we have an awful lot, and we're very lucky, of apple growers that people don't think about. If you ask people that live in Saratoga County, they could probably only name two orchards, one where they go to and one where they want to go to. But we have so many.
That is correct. We do. We have a lot of great orchards around, and orchards in areas where you wouldn't really even think of having an orchard in the middle of. For instance, if you take DeVos right down in the heart of, Half Moon there and in Clifton Park, And you wouldn't even really think about the fact that you've got this big vegetable and fruit grower, you know, sitting right on Route 9, right next door to the Walmart.
Yeah, I know. Well, when you talk about agriculture being the number one industry, I mean, you got to expect that because actually, probably 40 years ago or more, Clifton Park was nothing but probably farms.
Oh,
and
it
fields.
Was. It was a huge agriculture district, you know, and sad to say, we have very few within that, you know, township and between, you know, Clifton Park and Half Moon. Now we've really reduced ourselves down to hardly any, but it used to be one of the most booming areas for agriculture.
And the reason is because that area is the fastest growing area in Saratoga County.
It became that
most
bedroom
populous.
Community for, you know, Albany, and it made a nice commute. And during one of those earlier struggles that we had in agriculture, and, you know, we've gone through tons of them, you know, and we lost a few dairy farms. And when we lost those dairy farms in that region, you know, that became acreage that was available for housing. And, you know, since then, it just keeps on booming and growing.
Like I said,
and now
it's
you've
the
got
largest.
That moving into more of that Malta area now and coming up the line a little bit, and they're growing quite large in that area still as well.
Well, see, I think that's, you know, people say, Saratoga, you know, the track is what makes Saratoga or the historic places in Saratoga, but we always had those.
I mean,
for over 100 years. I think what made the area from Albany up north is the Northway.
Absolutely.
And what that did, I mean, that made it easier to get to these places.
Mm-hmm.
So Saratoga had three exits off the Northway, and it boomed. Then they put in, I think Clifton Park has three, if I'm not mistaken. They have 9, 8, and they ended up having to put another one in, 8A.
Right. Yep.
So, and just like Clifton Park expands out to Malta, to Half Moon and that, Saratoga's expanded out to Wilton, now to Greenfield.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think number one cause of all this growth is the Northway.
Well, it definitely aids, you know.
Yeah.
But now, if you think of that, you know, with any type of, you know, over history, that's really where your expansion came. If you think of the Erie Canal, when they built that, that's where everything expanded out westward.
Sure.
Because everything concentrated more over on the eastern part here of our locale. And the canal allowed everybody to expand westward, and things moved westward so that they could go there.
Buffalo,
you know, and then it just continued from there. Because once
with
the canal, they went from, you could transport something from, you know, New York City all the way out to, you know, you would continue because you got to the Great Lakes, you got to Buffalo, and then you hit the Great Lakes, and then you can transport anything
anywhere
throughout the Great Lakes system.
That's right.
You know, so, you know, the Northway kind of did the same kind of thing. So you saw where that growth really came from that, you know, those hundreds of years ago when the canal was originally built. You know, and now you're, you know, once the Northway came into play, you have the same kind of expansion, but instead of, you know, westward, this was the northern expansion.
Sure. Well, you know, I mean, and then you look at anything like the trains made the Midwest and that populous and getting food out all over the place to the, you know.
Yeah.
By the way, you know where the Great Plains are?
Okay, what's the punchline to this one?
They're in the Great Airport, of course. Everybody knows that, so but it's not agriculture, so you know.
Yeah. Knew there had to be a good punchline to this one.
So you know, you've been on the show for 15 years when we started down the line there, and all we did was a comedy show, I think, with Lynn back then.
Yeah.
But let's talk about the fall time of the year. I mean, we do the seasons with you.
And today's a beautiful fall day out there.
I know, and I think all weekend is supposed to be pretty neat. You know, we're blessed up in this part of the country. We complain about the snow, but you know what? We're ready for it up here, and when we get a big snowstorm, if it's in the morning and it happened overnight, you know, by midday you can go anywhere you want because the roads are pretty much clear. You know, it may be a pain in the neck for you to shovel, but, you know, it's great. We don't have the major catastrophes like they do in the south or the west, out west, or the middle of the country with the tornadoes. And so we're very fortunate here. You know, we have the mountains, and we have a beautiful valley, the Mohawk Valley, rich in history and beautiful towns off of there. So I hate, well, I shouldn't use hate, that's a strong word, but I dislike when people knock, you know, New York State or, well, sometimes New England can get hit from the being on the coast. They can get blasted a little bit, but, you know, in New York especially, and maybe Ohio, and that people complain about living up here in the north because it's too tough. And, you know, we really are blessed in what we have.
Oh, we really are. And the diversification is just what's so, it's so nice. Now, I spent a time living down in Georgia, you know. And,
sure.
And you can get into the nice little mountain area in Georgia and definitely see, you know, a better seasonal change than if you're, you know, in Atlanta. Because in Atlanta, you really aren't seeing any seasonal change.
Right.
You know, but, you know, this is just, you. We're so, it's so different. It's so, you know, it's, we're very unique in what it is that we have. And, you know, and in this particular region, you're so close to anything. And, you know, there's so many different things that are out there for you. And, you know, and you can go in any direction out of Saratoga and you're going to hit some gorgeous farmland. You're going to hit various types of things. It's either, you know, you'll find a llama farm, you'll find a good beef farm, you'll find some dairies, you'll find the apple orchards, you know, and it's a really short drive. It's not like you have to go any long distance to get to something and have a really enjoyable afternoon doing something.
And we have a large zoo in Broad Alban, which is an unbelievable surprise to anybody that goes there for the first time. They didn't realize that we had such a large business there that has every kind of animal you can think of. And I know a lot of schools take their class trips there.
And I mean,
we used to take our girls there all the time when they were younger. Yeah. Let's get back to the fall time of the year, because there's things that we have to do or should be doing or could be doing to help us not only maintain the beauty of what we have around our houses and shrubs, flowers and lawns now, but things that we can get ready for springtime. And one of the things here, and you're going to have to change the wording on the website here, with the leaves falling, which they haven't started yet, but I'm sure they've seemed to be dropping later in the year the past couple of years.
Well,
they've
actually, this year we've had a lot of early leaf fall because of the stresses of the kind of summer we had with the high humidity. So we actually do have certain species of trees that have really totally already defoliated.
Well, tell my big maple.
Just because of the, you know, weather conditions that we're dealing with.
Yeah, tell my big maple in the front lawn to start. I want to get it cleaned up, and I don't want to go into late October or early November. But this is a good time of the year to compost now?
Absolutely.
With the leaves? Now, do maple leaves make good leaves for composting, or are they acidic?
Maybe. No, actually, all leaves really make good compost. As long as you're mixing enough of everything in there, and you get the right amount, the right formula of your greens and your browns together, you know, it doesn't matter what that leaf is going to be. When you think of compost, and people have a tendency to say, like an oak or a pine is going to be, you know, heavily acidic, because they prefer to grow in more of an acid soil. You think that the plant material itself is extremely acidic, but as it's decomposing through that decomposition process, you actually end up with a very, very sweet and alkaline, you know, compost that you're going to get from that.
Okay.
So no compost is ever acidic.
Okay.
Regardless of what plant material you put into it.
Okay.
Because the decomposition changes that whole work of what it is.
That whole scheme. Now, do you have a tutorial on the website about how to compost for people?
Actually, we link to our Cornell Gardening website with the composting tutorial.
Okay.
And there is one on our Cornell Gardening site, and we link to that for that.
Okay, and the website for that is Saratoga County Cornell.
The link to that would be going through our CCESaratoga.org
okay.
website.
Yeah, because I've gone out to the, the main Cornell.
So if you just come to our local CCESaratoga.org site, okay. The link is right there to take you to that site.
You have a lot of good links off of that page. Yeah, no. I mean, off of your website, there's links to everything.
And we have a lot of written material on that as well. So if somebody's interested in something, they can call. We can, email materials off to them, or we can, put them through the mail to you. So there's all kinds of different materials that are out there that, can be shared onto that composting end. But you do want to think about the fact that, compost itself is actually very sweet, very alkaline. You could have compost, even though you might be in an area, because a lot of Saratoga County is pure sand, and a lot of our sand is very acidic, but not all of it. We have some really good little lime belts that run through the area. So we have some very, very, very alkaline sands. But we have a lot of sands that are more on that acidic side. But if you think of your compost is always going to be at least neutral, which is a 7.0 or higher. And we have composts that reach points that we really cannot do a test on ourselves. The pH scale runs all the way up to 14. We're only, in our local area, we can only do a pH up to an 8.6.
Sure.
And any time that we are testing something that's over an 8, it's already an issue. Because it's a problem when you get your pH that high. Compost, until it is fully decomposed, can easily be up in the area of a 9 or an 11. As far as the pH.
Right.
So, compost is a very different type of material as it goes through that decomposition. And usually by the time it's fully decomposed, it only makes it down to really a neutral pH, a pH of about 7. So there's really not any such thing as an acidic compost that's really available.
All right. Well, people want to do more themselves to save expenses today, because it's very expensive to get your to go to these outlets and buy your compost or whatever in 40-pound bags to add to your garden. So you can learn, you have the resources to learn how to start and maintain your compost bin, and learn how to turn your food and yard waste into black gold for your garden. And when you say food, I have a problem with the word black gold, because in the Beverly Hillbillies theme song, black gold was oil.
Oil.
So, but anyway, for right now, we'll use the term black gold. But what kind of food are we looking at to add to the yard debris for composting? I mean, you don't want to throw bones in there.
Yeah, anything other than meats.
Okay.
I mean, to be very honest, you want to stay away from meats, anything that's a very, very heavy oil, because you don't want to build up anything that's going to be a scent that's really going to try to draw in a lot of other critters either. So that's one of the reasons that you're really trying to avoid a lot of that, because you can get various types of rotting, stenches off of that.
Oh, yeah.
That will bring in other things. Anything else that you have, it can definitely go into there. So, food composting has become very, very important. And everybody thinks that when they think of food composting, often they think, that would be something that you want to do with, worms. No, you can put that food compost right into that, leaf mix as well.
Yeah.
It's not something that you have to, have yourself a nice little bucket of, red wigglers.
Right, right.
Now, sure, we can do that as well, and sometimes, if you're looking to break down some things, partially and then add them to the piles, maybe that's something that you want to be interested in doing as well as, using worm composting to do that, because some people find that, especially during the, the winter time is an easier thing to do where, they can, have a nice bin that they can, add shredded newspapers to, use their, various composting materials, and then, have, do some worm composting in a, in a side room or a basement area, they can then utilize that rather than going, back and forth to a compost pile outside. But, we can compost year round.
So that's
not something that is just a seasonal aspect.
Sure. And that's good for your vegetable garden, your flower gardens, perennial gardens.
The thing you want to watch out for when you're composting, if you have a very serious disease, your home compost pile is probably not going to get hot enough to actually break down one of those really serious diseases. So if you have a real serious disease in a garden, and, that's something that you really want to just bag and trash versus put it into the compost pile. Because otherwise, the compost pile won't get hot enough to really, alleviate that from it, that means when you're reintroducing that into a garden bed, you're reintroducing some of those spores, and then the disease is going to come back.
How about grass clippings? Can you add those into
a
compost?
Oh, absolutely, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Our phone number in the studio is 518-580-5783, 518-580-5783, if you want to ask Sue a question about your fall projects, and you're listening to WSPN 91.1 FM, Skidmore Radio. I've always been interested in composting, but I've never gotten the start to do that. First of all, we don't have a vegetable garden. We have perennial gardens and then the regular flower gardens, But
everybody does think of, they think, gee, you really need to have gardens in order to really compost. But, everybody's got a tree out in their yard.
Oh, yeah.
And those leaves compost down into something really, really great. And if you're just growing perennials, just top dressing with compost over that perennial garden is a great way to fertilize those perennials. So, just utilizing, between your grass clippings, between your tree leaves, between branches that are falling. I don't know. My yard has a lot of branches in it right now. Of all these different rainstorms that have come through, I've lost definitely a lot of twigs out in that area, and they are great to add to that compost pile as well. So, we don't want real thick, heavy, branches.
Sure.
But, the smaller twig areas, they are definitely would be going into the compost.
Yeah.
And then that can all, as it fully decomposes and breaks down, then you're using that for your nutrient base that you just top dress the rest of your gardens with. So it's not like you have to be growing vegetables in order to, do that. But a lot more people have gone into container gardening these days. So almost all homes really have vegetables grown. Just not grown in that type of a garden that we really think of when we think of, having a vegetable garden.
Now, do farmers compost quite a bit? Or
it really varies. It varies with the, farm of what it is you have as far as how much composting is really done.
Okay. Because it would seem they'd have the product to do a lot of composting with, if they can use it for the farm anyway.
Yeah.
It's mum time.
It is.
Not if you're in England, mum here means the flower mum.
Yeah, chrysanthemum.
For them, mum is mummy. But but it's, it's time for mums.
It is.
And you see them all over in people's porches and in their gardens or in their shrub areas in between.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you buy a mum in a store, or a garden center, whatever, and you plant it now, can you leave it in the ground so that it will come back? Are they flowers that will come back every year?
It really depends upon the mum that you're buying. Most of the mums, all mums have the ability to overwinter and come back. The problem that most homeowners have with mums is in order to get them into bloom at this time of year, you would have to actually be doing a lot of pinching onto the bloom, onto the plant as it comes back. You have to go in and deadhead it early in the season and keep pinching. And not deadheading, but deadheading and pinching are kind of interchangeable when you think about a plant. So, you know, you need to pinch, which is very similar to deadheading, in order for them to continue to bush out and then formulate, you know, a lot more flower buds. Otherwise, if you don't do that, you're going to have those mums in bloom the end of June, the beginning of July.
Okay.
And that's not what people typically are looking for. When they think of a chrysanthemum, they think of that as their fall flower.
Correct.
So in the landscape, it requires a lot of work on your part in order for you to leave them and have them rebloom to get them to bloom at this September time frame into October.
Okay.
You know, but sure, I mean, I have lots of mums growing that I've planted out here and there, but I let them just go naturally, and so I have mums blooming at various times throughout the season.
Yeah, now, you want to keep them compact, correct? Is that why you pinch them back?
That's why you're pinching them back, and you're trying to hold back the bloom so you don't get that flowering early on.
And then, too, if you get it early on with the summer months, I mean, that's not good for them probably unless you stay on top of watering and that, which I know everybody says that they do, but it's kind of like a forgotten item is to water everything in the summer, you know. I mean,
yeah, we do go through periods where, you know, people do forget, and, you know.
Well, especially this summer when we had heat for a really long period of time. But the humidity kind of takes care of some of that if you don't have to water as much, I don't think, correct? Because you got a lot of moisture
in the
air.
Yeah, you don't have to water as much, but if you started out too dry,
right,
then even with the humidity, that just really, you just sink at that point as to what it is that you have. And that becomes a real issue for us. And I think, in all honesty, a year like this year with the weather conditions that we had, the plant material that's probably struggling more than any is our evergreen plant material. Because if you realize, evergreens year-round are transpiring, year-round are using and losing lots of water. And when you have the kind of humidity we had this year, if you were cutting back and not watering things when Mother Nature wasn't providing any moisture in the sense of water, you have plants that were then utilizing a lot of their reserves.
Right.
And so now we have a lot of plants that are now under stress conditions and are a lot more susceptible to insects and diseases this late in the season and are going to be susceptible to winter kill if we don't start watering now and making sure that those plants are well watered going into the winter.
You know, we have a couple rhododendrons, and I know... Boy, I'll tell you, I think they require quite a bit of water during the summer because you'll see the leaves start to curl up. And if you water them really well, the next morning they're back to normal. So I think as a regular regimen, you need to water those especially well. And like you said, evergreens, the reason why they're... Probably always green is because not only the type of plant they are, but that means they need, like you said, water all year long.
All the time.
Which brings me to another topic, and we can get back to different flowers and that. Shrub covers. Now, if you cover... Let's say a rhododendron with, because I know in the spring when I take my shrub covers off, the rhododendron leaves are curled right up, dry, black spots on them. Obviously, they're not getting enough water or snow coverage to help when it's sunny out and it melts a little to take that water in. Are shrub covers good for bushes, plants? I know we have some spirea bushes. So when the snow lays on them, I mean, you know, they tend to split them, you know. So what is it with shrub covers?
Okay, well, you have all kinds of different ways that you can cover your shrubs. You know, and the most common, of course, is your, you know, I can't even think of what you would really call it. You know,
well, I use the wooden teepees.
Yeah, like. that's what I was just going to say, the teepee type, you know, covers that you have out there. You know, and the teepee covers actually allow really good airflow, and they, you know, so it is good to have. If you've got a plant in an area where it's going to have the potential of having a lot of snow load on it, you know, a shrub cover is an excellent thing to be utilizing. You still have really great air movement around the plant material, and you're protecting that plant from really having any severe breakage near the main portion of the plant itself. And so it's very, very important, you know, to have that. And then we have our shrub covers that we may be doing where we're staking around, you know, a plant's rows, and we're going to put really more wind protections in there, and people will still consider those as shrub covers. And what they really are is wind protection. If we're putting burlap up around, you know, various stakes in the ground to protect something, that really becomes wind protection from the severe types of wind conditions that we would have. Now, sometimes people will take them to the extreme that burlap is wrapped directly around the plant itself. And as long as you have the right kind of burlap, a natural burlap, you're going to probably have decent enough breathability through most of the season. But where people make a lot of mistakes is they're using some of these burlaps that are now more synthetic-based and have more
plastic
to them. And in that, there you do not have the breathability. And that becomes a real problem. You can get more of a severe burn from wrapping a plant tightly.
Then you're protecting it from wind burn. Yeah.
So you have to be very, very cautious with what you're doing. So, you know, the more teepeed area that we're looking at for covers probably are better because they're allowing all of that good airflow. But your biggest key from what, you know, and you're saying that you're getting those leaves curl, we're always going to have leaf curl on rhododendron. We can never supply enough water to a rhododendron to actually allow it to not have some leaf curl during the winter.
Okay.
It's always going to have some leaf curl. But seriously, you do need to be watering that right up until the time that ground freezes.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where people cut back. You know, they think, oh, I'm in the fall. We have a lot of rains in the fall. Well, you know, sometimes our rains are good penetrating rains and sometimes they're not. So you really kind of have to watch what kind of weather we really have. And if you've got a real serious amount of evergreens on your property, it becomes really essential to make sure that they're watered well. Now, that's your rhododendrons, especially your boxwoods. We can lose a boxwood in this area so rapidly from winter. You know, because we just dry out and those boxwoods are just going to die right off. And once you get a portion of that boxwood dying, you're going to get some of the more serious diseases that you have out there that are going to occur onto that plant. So it's really important that we're really watering really well. But even in all of those situations, as you're watering as well as you can up until that, you know, the ground really totally freezes, you're still going to find if you've got years with a really large temperature swing, which we almost every year have.
Mm-hmm.
3 years ago, we kind of didn't, but prior to the, all the years before and the years since, we've had great temperature swings, you're going to see some curled leaves. The amount of curl is going to be dependent upon how much water the plant really had to utilize.
Okay. Now, I built my own shrub covers, the TP kind.
Mm-hmm.
And I did not, sometimes I see the slats right together, pushed right together, side by side. Now, I left a gap of about maybe half an inch or a little bit less in between because I figured that would let more air in rather than just getting it from the sides. Is that what people should do when they're building their own?
Yes. Yeah. And actually, a larger gap is even, you know, better.
Right.
You know.
Because it'll take on a little bit of snow.
Yeah, you know, and it's okay. And it's actually good for the plant to have a little bit of that snow.
Sure.
It's going to give it some of that extra moisture that you're going to be looking for. So it's good for it to have the snow. But you're trying to keep that snow to a lessened portion so that you're not going to get the severe breakage onto it. So yeah, the larger the gap actually is, the better off you are, because then you have a much better airflow. You just don't want that airflow to really be through the side. You want as much airflow around that plant as you possibly can have.
Good. Now, I've seen people and plants that maybe they don't want to put a shrub cover on it, and that have a leaf coverage on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
Now, is that okay, or should people just rake them out?
Yeah. It really depends upon the plant as far as whether it's better to leave some of those leaf masses or not. The one thing you need to keep in mind when you're putting a lot of leaves around a plant material is that a large pile of leaves is going to draw your mice and your voles. And those voles are going to be feeding onto those plant roots. And so if you leave a lot of leaves, you're probably going to see some damage to your shrubs from the fact that you've got little critters out there feeding on that root system.
Yeah.
Or if you're bringing in the mice, they're going to be girdling around that plant material.
Right.
And start gnawing away at it. And if you get a full 360 girdling, your plant is... Depending upon the plant, like if you get a full 360 girdling on a burning bush, you're probably not going to lose it.
Right.
It's going to recover. It's going to take some time. But if we get a 360 girdling occurring around a sapling maple, that tree's gone.
Gone.
You know, it will grow for another 2 years probably,
yep.
And then it will die, and it will die in a year that you'll have weather conditions that you'd be like, gee, why did it die? Well, it died from that girdling 2 years ago. It will live long enough. It'll carry on enough as to whatever it has in its system left to go, and then it dies off. So, you know, it's not going to necessarily be an instantaneous death that spring. And that's where people really say, you know, how come? You know, what's happening? But most things that happen to plants over the winter, they will not immediately die the following spring. They'll die the spring after, or 2 years from when that severe condition hit that plant material.
So what we're doing too is we're leaving the ground warm enough where these critters can not only winter over, but have food on materials that we paid money for.
The better thing to do is to make sure those leaves are away from the plants until the ground freezes. And then if you wanted to put the leaves down around the plant as your mulch versus some other type of mulch, you could do it after the ground actually freezes, and you would lessen the amount of critters you have. But what people have a tendency to do is they'll let the leaves stay wherever they fall, let them just stay mulched and continue to mulch in that area, and that just keeps our soils very, very warm and keeps the activity level of all the critters in that area.
Well, it's a preference of mine to rake them all out because I don't like leaves on the lawn or in the bushes, so I rake everything out.
Yeah,
but that's just how I am.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a little bit nutty.
Yeah. You know, and of course now as you are starting to get some of this leaf fall right now, if you're out there and if you're one of those people who doesn't want to do a lot of raking, we can, you know, mow those leaves, you know, and just break them up and leave them onto the lawns. It's really not an issue. But it can only be done if we're doing it piecemeal throughout.
Sure.
You can't allow a whole large leaf layer to cover your lawn and then go in with your mower and expect to break it up and get it fine enough at that point to actually decompose well and feed the lawn. So you need to be mowing right along the line, so it may require more mowings. So the question becomes, would you rather mow more often, or is it easier to just go out and rake them?
Sure. Okay. I think that was good on the shrub covers because it reinforced what I did was right, and usually not as much right as I am wrong.
This is where we really miss Lynn, because he would have a good one and come in on that.
He would too. He may even call in from now on when he gets settled up north. Call in and just put the zingers in, you know. I want to do some public service announcements now, because we're at the three-quarter point of the show. We're calling talking about high school dropout prevention. Inside every student is a graduate. For some, it's easy to find, but not for all. For many high school students, sometimes the difference between dropping out and graduating can be a boost. A boost from someone in their life, a friend, a parent, a teacher, a coach who can help these kids see just what they have potential to become. Visit boostup.org to find out how you can help someone who may be struggling to finish high school. Boostup.org, because high school is hard, but graduating is harder. Brought to you by the U.S. Army and Ad Council. One other thing I would like to put in on that, this will be part of what you specialize in. Not every child is meant to go to college. And I think parents have to realize that. You don't want to push kids into college if they're not prepared to go, because they'll drop out of college and then not have anything. My suggestion to people is that we have a great Votech Center, and there are great Votech Centers all around New York State, as I'm sure there are around the country, who offer wide varieties of trade learning, plumbing, electrical, woodworking, farming, large equipment operating, police, basic police courses, so you can get in, horticulture, cooking programs. I've known some students who went there and became chefs, and went to the chef college here in Schenectady, has a great program and have went on. Don't forget about trade schools, because if your child's not meant to go to college, they can learn a trade and be set for the rest of their life. Even when time gets tough, because you may need an electrician, you may need a plumber, and they're always there. But if you've got a plumber with a master's degree, they're probably working for a company that would downgrade someday and they'll be out of a job. So it's not bad to learn a trade. Now, there's no stigma attached to it. If you're an auto mechanic and you learned it in Votech school, you've got a job anytime. So I love that public service announcements, but you can also get help from your guidance counselor on wanting to learn a trade. So that would be my advice, and that's a public service announcement too. So I've covered my public service announcements time. I want to talk about cover crops that we talked about a little bit, but they do a lot more than just protect the plant. They suppress weeds. They protect the soil from rain or runoff. They reduce surface crusting. Is it good to go around a shrub or a bush? I don't know what they call the tool, but it's like a little, it's got tines on it, little thing. And I used to go around my shrubs all the time and use that and scrape up the dirt and keep it loose. Is that a good thing to do, or is that?
It's not dirt, it's soil.
Soil, that's right. You get dirty from working in soil.
Yeah, no. Dirt is what is found on your shoes, your clothes, and you know what you bring into the kitchen floor. It's soil because it's living organisms.
Please forgive me.
Yeah.
I stand corrected.
Yeah.
So is that, a good thing to do, maybe even throughout the year to...
And anything that you can do to help get some more oxygen into the soil is always good, because then it really keeps the microorganisms, thriving. So having those kinds of changes of any sort can definitely be very helpful. And that's one of the things that you can do if you're, you know, running, you know, spikes through something. You know, sometimes what people will just do a use, as you're saying, some of the three-prong tools or the weasels, you know, out in an area just to kind of break that crusting for that. What that does is allows more oxygen flow to get into that, into the root area. You want to make sure when you're doing something like that that you're not doing something too drastic when you're doing it, because many of your plant material, the big feeder roots are really right there at the surface, so you don't want to be doing a lot of breakage to the feeder roots.
Correct.
So you need to be very careful when you're doing that, that you're not, you know, really disturbing for, you know, any large extent, you know, something that you have, so that we're not going to affect the actual plant growth at that point. But anything we can do to get more oxygen into the soil, it's just better for the microorganisms. The more microorganism activity you have, then the more nutrients you have. And this is what ends up happening. And in a situation like a lawn situation, let's, you know, just get ourselves away from a garden itself. But if you go into a lawn, if you're building up too thick of a thatch layer, what you've done is you've cut off everything naturally that can happen for that plant. And so knowing what kind of a thatch layer you have is very, very important. You know, I had a sample that just came in this week where somebody was having some diseases on their lawn. Their thatch layer was anywhere from an inch to an inch and a half. And the sample that they brought in was just a very small sample. We're talking a 6x6 chunk of the lawn. And to have that kind of variation in a sample that small is very, very drastic, you know. But so anything you're doing to your lawn in that situation, if you're trying, if you're saying, well, you know, I fertilize and it doesn't seem to improve it, the fertilization can never get down to where the actual roots should really be growing, because it will never penetrate through that thatch layer. So culturally, a lot of work needs to be done on that kind of particular lawn situation in order to have that lawn thrive. You know, you need to get in there. You'll need to do some extremely heavy raking. You know, and maybe, I'm not one for, you know, these power dethatchers, but in a situation like that, it may actually help, just so that you can alleviate and get that layer down to maybe a half an inch versus that inch to inch and a half. A core aeration would be better, but I know that people don't have core aerators and, you know, as part of their equipment in their yard, and they're harder to get, you know, your hands on. And we don't have a lot of companies that go out and do a lot of core aeration. So, you know, you can rent, walk behind core aerators, but maybe you want to get together with the neighbors and do it all together, because to rent it just for yourself for an hour can really be rather costly in comparison to if you could bring it into the neighborhood and you could do three houses instead in that day and split the cost. You know, but anything, you know, the whole key in this whole situation there is trying to get better oxygen down into the roots, because what was happening in this lawn situation is there just wasn't any nutrients getting to the plants. And the plants became very stressed, and with the kind of weather conditions we had this year, it just made them much more susceptible to all the diseases. And sadly, we can look outside and we can find, and I will say, 50% of our homes this year have lost large portions of their lawn to diseases. Mm-hmm. And that is because of the high temperatures and humidity that we had. And the diseases became very prevalent. We stressed our grasses. We were not watering.
Right.
So we stressed them even greater. You know, Mother Nature didn't add the water to us, and many of us don't have irrigation systems. And those who did, many of them were actually over-irrigating, thinking they needed to do more because of the weather conditions we had, and causing themselves the diseases because they over-irrigated.
And the roots come up closer to the surface if you're watering too much.
Yep.
One of the keys that you told me in prior shows about mowing is to mow high.
Right.
Because not only will that make the grass stronger and not as prevalent to disease, but when you're cutting higher, your clippings are smaller, so when they go into the lawn, they can probably be decomposing a lot faster than if you mow as low as the as you can, and you've got large thatch. I mean, that's not going to decompose. It's going to dry.
Your clippings really are not part of your thatch layer, But your clippings will take a lot longer. The longer the clipping is, the longer it takes to decompose, the worse it is. Well, your thatch layer is really your dead grass plants and your dead root system. And when that thatch gets too big, if you don't have the right nutrient balance in the soils, it's going to take them longer to decompose. And that's really where you start getting the heavy thatches. If you've got a really good, healthy lawn, regardless of what your situation is and regardless of what kind of grass you have, you're not really going to build up a thatch layer over a half an inch ever, because you're going to constantly be having, you know, great decomposition that's going to take place, and you may never have to do anything. It's those lawns that we have a tendency to cut a little bit shorter, that we're not getting as good of a breakdown in our clipping, which our clipping is really 30% of your nitrogen needs for your lawn can occur from clippings. So if you return your grass clippings to your lawn, you can cut out a fertilization. Because 30% of that fertilizer needs would come from those grass clippings.
Okay, we're going to be in our speed round here because we got 6 minutes left. Okay. I want to ask you quickly about the Master Gardener program. I know it's in the spring.
We're taking our applications right now.
If you're interested
in doing the Master Gardener program, we actually start with our orientation early in January, and then our first class starts in January, and we run January through mid-May with our program. We meet once a week for that, but we're taking applications right now for that program.
Okay.
So you would need to be in touch with us as soon as you can so that you can get your application. We do not have the application online, so you do need to contact us in order to get your application, but you could contact us by going online and just going to our website. Or just giving us a call.
You need to get that
application into us get to us as soon as possible.
Because they fill up quick.
Can get that application out to you.
Yeah, and that fills up quick.
It does. And there is a long process to this. We do an interview. There are reference checks. There's background checks. You know, you're a volunteer for our organization, and as a nonprofit, we need to go through all of that in order to have you be a volunteer for us.
Sure.
So it is a long process. It's not a short process, so don't procrastinate. Give us a call right away.
Phone number is 518-885-8995, and if you can ask for Sue or the girl that answers the phone. You want to find out information on the Master Gardener program, and she'll transfer you over.
And our receptionist is real good at that. And if we're not in and available to answer those questions right away, honestly, we'll send you out all kinds of great information with the application. So just make sure you leave your name and address, and we'll get an application out to you right away.
Okay. Now I want to just talk about holidays are coming up, and a lot of people have beautiful Christmas cactuses, or Easter cactuses, which they think are Christmas cactuses. But if they're not budding now, is there any way what they can do to get them so that they bloom around the holiday? Get them into a cool room.
That's really the key. Get them into a cool room. You don't want to get extreme temperatures onto them at this point in time. And as we're starting to kick in people's heating systems as they're going now, the cooler room, the better. The cool room is going to set those buds, and then they're going to be in bloom for you. So, put them in a room that's, not really heavily used. Lots of people have an extra room in the home that, kids have moved out of and isn't really necessarily, being used for a whole lot more than, a wonderful little storage area.
Sure. I know. You put more junk in another room that but now sometimes cellars are cool. You do have a little vent coming off of the furnace sometimes, but it's still not as warm if you put them in as far away from the furnace. It'll stay cool.
It'll stay cool, but in that situation, you might need to give it some supplemental light as well, though.
Okay.
Because you don't want to have them in total darkness. Unlike the poinsettia that we were trying to bring back into bloom.
Right.
That really needs to have some really, really dark days in order for those bracts to color up.
Okay.
We usually say put them in a basement with no lights, or put it into a closet area, bring it out now and then, and that's it. But with the Christmas cactuses, you definitely need to still have a little bit of light onto them.
Okay, and for the poinsettias, they need less light. But do you bring them out at a certain point before the holidays so they get more light?
Yes, you do.
So, probably the beginning of December or the end of November?
Correct.
So you have them nice and red for the holiday season. Okay. Well, listen, Sue, I appreciate you coming on today. As always, it's great having you on, not only just to say hi and see you, but getting a lot of great information. And Cornell Cooperative Extension is a great resource for everything. I mean, you'd be surprised, even life issues, kids,
and of course, when we have our fall series with our various cooking classes, the make and take classes on the preservation and everything.
Was that reservation or preservation?
Preservation.
Okay, preservation. Okay, very good. I want to say that the phone number again is 518-885-8995, and
correct.
The email or the website is
CCESaratoga.org,
and you can go there, and they have links to other areas where you can get more information, and please use them as a resource. You would never have to guess or talk to a friend and get wrong information. You can call them up, and I'm telling you, they're their greatest resource for a lot of things. So, Sue, thanks again for being on.
Well, thanks for having me.
No problem. And right now we're going to turn it over to Big John at Polka Magic. And you, everybody have a great weekend, and we'll be back next Saturday right here.
Ample Eagle, and you'll be informed with news from Poland and from the Polish communities across the U.S. Polish recipes, a Polonia calendar, and articles about our heritage. There's a polka music section called the Polka Beat, where you'll read about